And the problem that these small organizations have is if you buy an external expertise, because you have to do, because either you haven't got a demand to employ your own, or if you did, the cost of employment would be very high. The cost of buying in external advice becomes very high. And I think the only way that can be addressed without compromising the standards is, of course, to make more people develop more skills and more knowledge. And that, in a challenging way, is a long, long-term problem. That is the biggest problem we have in the UK at the moment, and actually in a lot of countries. It's that the cost of implementing CITOT can quite often outweigh, as it may be seen within a smaller business context, the benefit.
You're listening to the ISF podcast for your organization's better cybersecurity. Your host, ISF CEO Steve Durbin, is an expert in leadership, business culture transformation, and cyber strategies for today's top enterprises. I'm producer Tavia Gilbert. Today's episode is the first of two conversations between Steve and Brian Lord, the Chief Executive Officer of Protection Group International. Prior to joining PGI, Brian served as the Deputy Director of a UK government agency, overseeing the organization's cyber and intelligence operations. Brian shares his knowledge of both the public and private sector in this wide-ranging conversation, and Steve and Brian touch on the challenges SMEs face in implementing cyber defenses, what effective cooperation between government and the private sector looks like, and the role insurance may play in cybersecurity.
So, Brian, you've had a varied career both in public and private sector. Without me sort of going into detail about it, why don't you take on the mic and tell us a little bit about the breadth of your work and your experience? Just give listeners some context.
Absolutely. I mean, I've been working in this industry, first of all, for government, for GCHQ, for around just over 20 years. So progressed through those 20 years environmentally and adjusted and adapted to what the sort of the targets threw at us in terms of evolution of communications, evolution of different adversarial strategies. And then I obtained the position of deputy director at GCHQ. Then I moved to the private sector. And I think one of the differences and one of the drivers around joining the private sector was it became very apparent both in the area where the risk and threat to our national interests from a digital perspective was coming increasingly through what was deemed then and termed then cyber attack. But it became increasingly apparent that the main response to this, if we were going to look adopt a societal approach, if you like, the main response to this was going to come from the private sector. So right. I joined then a company called Protection Group International as the managing director for their cybersecurity division, which had a number of divisions at the time, including what was then referred to as an intelligence, a source intelligence division, which will become apparent later. Then in 2020, I was made chief executive officer of the whole company. And what we do now, I think, is easiest to describe in probably three big handfuls. One there is core cybersecurity. How do we help government clients, commercial clients protect themselves from what is deemed to be online threat, cyber threat, hacking, theft of data, disruption of systems, and so on? How can they put in place the mechanisms to allow their organizations or government departments to run efficiently? The other element of that is understanding the information landscape. So understanding increasingly how information, particularly but not exclusively, the information landscape which we operate in now can be used to disseminate disinformation, for example, to manipulate electoral processes, to be able to allow criminals to carry out sort of more online crime. And then sitting on top of that, we work under the auspices of the UK government to help UK allies build their own national capability in both cybersecurity and the countering disinformation and information manipulative landscape. So that's my career. So 10 years in the private sector doing that on the back of 20 years in the public sector and picking up all the changes that have happened over that time, which have been really sort of quite revolutionary in many ways.
Yeah, it has. I mean, the landscape has changed immensely over that period of time, hasn't it? I was interested that you made this point about public and private, or government and private sector cooperation. I don't think you used exactly those words, but tell us a little bit more about that. Because, I mean, there may be people listening to this thinking, well, how's that going to work? Because obviously, you know, in the government sector, particularly, say, GCHQ, there are certain things that clearly are not going to be widely shared.
Yeah.
Yet, are there some of those that for the private sector to be working properly or to their best collaboratively with government should need to be shared. So how does all of that work? What I suppose I'm really asking is, how can we get this coming together of public and private sector, given some of the constraints that exist out there?
Yeah, I mean, I'm recognising the constraints that you have. The very nature of the work of GCHQ, of course, means there's a whole load of information and knowledge that can't be shared for national security reasons. But I think there is an awful lot of public-private cooperation in this space, both at a ad hoc level and at a formula level. And we also have to bear in mind as well that the very nature of how we run government at the moment, an awful lot of the cybersecurity capability for government departments, government organisations, is provided under contract by the private sector. So the private sector increasingly is helping or directly providing cybersecurity capability to the UK government as well as to commercial entities. And so therefore, information sharing about the novel threats, the nature of new attacks, which is best done, I think, at the National Cybersecurity Organization, which, of course, is a part of GCHQ. The information sharing that comes out of there is really quite comprehensive. And there's a lot of effort and a lot of forums and a lot of structured forums where that information flow is quick and where it's dynamic. And so where those who are supporting the commercial sector can pick up on the kind of techniques that are seen against the higher end of UK government, and then shared those before they manifested themselves further. So I think, you know, even though it's very easy for a lot of us to be able to point to lots of different cyber attacks, if you were, I think the UK has got a pretty strong track record in maintaining its infrastructure and its defences against cyber attack really, really quite significantly. And that is a result of the public-private partnership. And of course, the other dimension to that is one of the things the National Cybersecurity Centre does, as you know, is set a lot of regulatory standards which are mandated for government departments and then mandated for suppliers of critical national infrastructure and then advisory further down the commercial stack you go. So you also have most of the UK commercial and government entities all operating under the same set of safeguards, the same regulatory standards, which allows us to keep those standards high. So I think there is a lot of cooperation. And I think one of that was one of the purposes of creating, there are many purposes of creating the National Cybersecurity Centre. But one of those purposes was to make sure there was a public, if you like, facing element of what is by definition a fairly secret organisation to allow information flow to go without compromising national security. And I think in general, like all things, it can probably work a little bit better. But I think it's a fairly well-tested relationship, which I think is quite strong.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned this whole regulatory space, and you mentioned critical infrastructure and larger organisations. But one of the areas that concerns me is lower down the corporate stack, as you put it, you know, the supply chain elements, the small to mid-size enterprises that, particularly here in the UK, of course, make up the lion's share of business. Yeah. And what I hear constantly from those kinds of organisations is that they are becoming somewhat overwhelmed by this burden of legislation, of regulation. And to a certain extent, they don't have too much choice because they exist within this supply chain. So they have their bigger backers, if you like, who are clearly trying to protect their environment. And yet they don't have the resources or the capability to be able to implement some of the regulation or guidance that the people at the NCSC are moving forward with. So what is the solution for this very, very large part of the business community that from a cyber threat actor standpoint is pretty inviting?
Oh, indeed. I think it's an extraordinarily good question, because I think as we have seen through the evolution of the cyber threat, say, well, almost back to the turn of the century and slightly before that, but as we look at the kind of mainstreaming of understanding of the cybersecurity threat, I think there was a tendency at start for attention, media attention, public attention, even community attention to be focused at the top end, the critical national infrastructure, government, lots of stories of sort of apocalyptic kind of scenarios. Now, criminals, if you like, sort of made hay against the lower level commercial organizations, standard criminality, and the lower level organizations go, what on earth is this about? Therefore, that led to introduction of different layers of standards, you know, right down to the basic Cyber Essentials, Cyber Essentials Plus. And the government then sort of put in a layer of advisory regulatory standards that they, in some cases, the advised commercials should follow. But of course, when it came to the commercial entities being part of a government supply chain, then, of course, those regulations were mandatory. And I think there were two fundamental problems with that as the nature of that problem grew, exactly as you pinpointed, Steve. First of all, let's look at the knowledge. A small organization, does it have that kind of knowledge, that kind of capability, that kind of expertise to be able to build the defenses to these regulatory standards? And I think invariably, the answer was no, so they have to buy it in. right? So it becomes an overhead. It becomes an overhead of doing work with government, or it becomes a commercial overhead if you want to improve your cybersecurity services. That's all well and good. The cost of a basic cyber essentials is not really that much, but it's certainly less than £1,000. The problem being is once you start moving beyond those very, very basic levels into higher levels that are demanded by the supply chain of the critical national infrastructure providers or government itself, you then get the problem of cost. The problem of cost, and both of those problems can coalesce at one single point. And the single point is the scarcity of people who can do the type of work that is necessary to do the mandatory testing, the mandatory assurance for organizations. So what we have is a high demand for people and a very, very few number of people that are capable to do it. And there is an inevitability about that market, inevitability about that situation, which is the costs of that kind of advice, that kind of testing, go up and up and up. And the problem, therefore, being that these small organizations have is if you buy an external expertise, because you have to do, because either you haven't got a demand to employ your own, or if you did, the cost of employment would be very hard. The cost of buying in external advice becomes very high. And I think the only way that can be addressed without compromising the standards is, of course, to make more people to develop more skills and more knowledge. And that, in a challenging way, is a long, long-term problem to be able to build the core capacity of people in this area, not just with the deep, deep technical skills, but also with the technical knowledge and understanding to be able to provide some of the wider regulatory assurance. That is the biggest problem we have in the UK at the moment, and actually in a lot of countries. The cost of implementing cybersecurity can quite often outweigh, as it may be seen within a smaller business context, the benefit. And I think that's a problem that we still live with, and I still think it's a problem that we still have to address fully.
Now, NCSC, of course, has tried very hard to address some of these areas with things like cyber essentials, making certain things freely available to the smaller organisations. Yet it probably isn't able to go far enough because, as you just pointed out, there are some very deep-rooted problems which will only ever be solved with significant investment over a long period of time. And that creates a gap for us, doesn't it? So what is it, in your opinion, that we could be doing to fill that gap in the short term? Because skill shortages are not going to go away. We can't train up sufficient people in the short term. Don't really want to get into the issue of immigration and where that might go. What are some of the solutions? You know, if I'm a small business owner listening to this, I'm holding a lot of data. I'm probably a little bit concerned. Where do I go? What can I do?
Well, I think the issue around the result, as well, on top of the free advice, I absolutely take your point. The National Cybersecurity Centre is very good at giving free advice. But let's take it a step beyond that. You have an organisation who has a lot of data. They worry about the integrity of that data. They worry about their reputation within that. And I don't want to move away from the skill things, because the skill thing is actually key to just about everything. But I take your point. I absolutely take your point. That's all very well, Brian, but change the fundamental skill profile is going to take a generation or more. Yep. So we do for the next 15 to 20 years. And I think it's almost an intractable problem, other than we have to recognize, how do we maintain, how do we apply, let's just say, a ceiling or a cap, if you like, on the fees that a small organization has to take in order to implement those. You can't necessarily give it free. The free market just will not allow that. But I think a lot more, I think, industry, the cybersecurity industry and government can do to be able to actually start putting a little bit more constraints around when one is providing assurance for particularly small to medium businesses. What is the cap on the fees that you can charge? And how does an organization continue, a cybersecurity organization, continue to be sustainable with the help and the support of the government? That's not an easy challenge to have, because the money has to come from somewhere. Because what we certainly don't want to happen, as we can see that, is because if the limited skill base that we have in this country then feels that their ability to generate their career, and to be quite frank, without being too avaricious about it, for the individual saying, well, I can get a better salary in Australia, I can get a better salary in the US. We don't want a brain drain, because this is the key to everything that we have. So I think there probably needs to be a lot more tangible support, I think, for the small to medium enterprises. But that can only come out of collaboration with the cybersecurity industry and with government about how do you make sure that some of the fees around that are capped? How do you make sure that there is relationships with insurers? Because, of course, one has to bear in mind the insurance industry plays a really key element in this place as well.
It does,
insurance. What does that triangulation of insurance, government, the providers of these services, how can that be configured to make sure that the cost to a small to medium enterprise, where the measures of security are very, very important, but they're a lot more standard, perhaps, than if you move into critical national infrastructure space and they're having to look at industrial control systems and far more complex systems. So if you're talking about a relatively small, there are more steps that could be had, and I think a lot more could be done to generate that.
Yeah, certainly one for us to keep an eye on, I think, as it continues to evolve, because you're absolutely right. It is critical to pretty much every business going forward.
We'll be back next week with the second part of Steve's conversation with Brian Lord. If you found value in the conversation today, please rate and review the podcast and share this episode. To become a member, get in touch with Steve directly at steve.durbin@securityforum.org or on LinkedIn at Steve Durbin. Check out all our media and resources. All of it is there to support you at securityforum.org. Don't miss the ISF Analyst Insight podcast, sharing conversations with members about the real-world applications of ISF research. The ISF podcast is produced by Talkbox Productions and Tavia Gilbert. Thanks for listening.